Newcastle. We come to the end of the circle, the final episode in our 10-cycle series here. In the morning, of course, focusing on shamatha, and we come to the final phase in the teachings, according to the teachings of Padmasambhava, in the practice of shamatha without a sign. And clearly this practice, more explicitly than any other shamatha practice, is designed not only to achieve shamatha, but to really shed light on the very nature of consciousness in the process. Mindfulness of breathing is an utterly marvelous practice, and it's so straightforward, it's so clear, transparent, and it's all about developing attention skills. Attention, metacognition, developing stability and vividness of attention. That's what it's for, and it's really, really good. Settling the mind is a brilliant technique. It's so simple, but really deep, and it really illuminates the nature of the mind, as in the mental events arising, emotions, desires, states of consciousness, space of mind. It's just an incredibly rich practice, ripe, fertile, with insights that are just waiting to come into blossom. And then awareness of awareness is just going right towards straight line to fathoming through direct experience. Like, again, Galileo looking through his telescope, just direct observation. What is the nature of the phenomenon? Consciousness. Now, clearly, that's not the only way. Not the only way to understand consciousness. We can come at it straightforwardly, come at it from an angle, we can come at it explicitly, or we can come at it implicitly, observationally, or by way of inference, logic, analogy, and so forth. So there are certainly multiple ways. I would never, ever say there's only one way to understand consciousness. In the midst of this, within the broader context of our retreat here, it's not just about understanding the nature of consciousness, although that is extremely central. But it's also very much about, of course, developing attention skills and developing these qualities of the heart, of loving-kindness, compassion, and so on. Well, 18 years ago, I was with this wonderful group of neuroscientists. I referred to them before. Went high up in the mountains above Dharamsala, where the yogis are, way up in the mountains, lugging up all of our technology, our equipment. And among the various yogis who we interviewed, that we spoke with, kind of almost tried to start a courtship with, you know, a little relationship, there were two in particular. They were both very senior, who'd been up there for 20 years or so. I mean, really, they were lifelong yogis. And there were two who just, they were incredibly, both very sweet, very gentle, warm, kind, gracious, and both just unequivocally refused to do any collaborative research at all. Nope. I remember one in particular, when the scientists, and they were so friendly. I mean, these were there was nothing arrogant or pushy about them. They're just, every single one of them, very nice people. They all remain my friends, except for one who's passed away, and I wish he were still alive, because I want to be his friend still, Francisco Varela. But one of them, so there was, it was good spirit all around, you know, good friendliness all the way around. But one yogi in particular, I remember when he learned that these scientists wanted to understand about how, you know, the refinement of attention through shamatha. That's what they're interested in, two things: refinement of attention through shamatha, and then compassion. And they brought up all their equipment with the EEG and the video screens and so forth. And he looked at them. I think I can remember his face to this day. He just looked at them with just incredible sweetness, but a bit of bemusement. And he said, "You'd like to understand shamatha and compassion? Good, I'll teach you shamatha and compassion." This is how you understand how it works, by doing it. But will I let you study my brain so you can understand shamatha and compassion? No, I won't let you do that. And another one who had spent a good deal of time in the West, I invited him. He was the yogi who was the principal instructor for the shamatha project, the one year shamatha retreat 22 years ago. He was pretty savvy. He'd spent time in the West. And he was very explicit, and again, with incredible warmth and kindness, but he said, "No, I won't do it." He gave a couple of reasons, but one was, all of your assumptions are materialistic. All of your assumptions are materialistic. And from our perspective, from my perspective, this is fundamentally delusional, and I just don't want to do collaborative research that's going to reinforce a delusion. Now, one might think, well, that's a bit harsh, a little bit, really? But years later, one of the leading researchers, scientific researchers, meditation, made two comments that really caught my attention and made me think back to this yogi 18 years ago. One of the statements is, and this is pretty much verbatim, by a neuroscientist, oh, the only way to understand meditation is by studying the underlying neural mechanisms of the meditative process. That's the only way. So the yogis weren't saying this, but the scientist was very happy to say that. And then added, we neuroscientists, in particular this person's own lab, we expect to understand how meditation works within 5 years. Well, I was thinking of parallel. Imagine that a neuroscientist or a behavioral psychologist or what have you, a cognitive psychologist, got really interested in mathematics, in theoretical physics, and let's say superstring theory. It's extremely elegant, perhaps the most elegant mathematical theory, that is in terms of theoretical physics, that anybody's ever devised. I mean, I don't understand it, never even tried. But those experts in it, they say this is just incredibly, mind-blowingly magnificent mathematics, superstring theory. And it presents 11 dimensions of physical reality. Imagine there was a neuroscientist that really wanted to understand mathematics, theoretical physics, and really especially wanted to understand string theory, superstring theory. And he goes to, I checked the names just recently, I've met both of them, two of the shining lights in superstring theory. One is Ed Witten, he's at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. The other one is David Grose, a Nobel laureate in physics, at the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. Two of the shining lights in that field of superstring theory. Imagine a neuroscientist going to Ed Witten and David Grose and saying, you know, I'm really, really interested in mathematics, the very process of experiencing a mathematical proof, how does that occur? And I want to understand mathematical physics and especially string theory. Would you come into my lab so I can put an EEG cap on you, and so I can understand while you're doing mathematics, I want to understand electromagnetic fields generated by your brain. And I want to watch behavior. And I want to watch behavior, facial expressions and things like that when you're doing mathematics. And when you get a proof, when you understand something, I want to get you in the MRI to see if I can really understand what it is to understand a mathematical proof. And I want to see which parts of the brain light up. And then I'm going to write a paper, because after all, I have to tell you, the only way to understand mathematics, physics, and string theory is by understanding the underlying neural mechanisms. But we'll let you know after we've studied your EEG, the fMRI, studied your behavioral expressions, we'll let you know how it works out. Because we scientists, we neuroscientists, we have the only way. I wonder how eager they would be. Oh, by the way, we figure we're going to understand it in 5 years. But we won't need to study. We don't need to study mathematics. We won't need to do mathematics. We won't need to get any education in mathematics or physics at all. We'll understand it purely in terms of the underlying neural mechanisms, because that's where the action really is. And by the way, our understanding of physics pretty much stopped in the 19th century. But that shouldn't matter, should it? We study consciousness the old-fashioned way, the Galilean way, the way of Charles Darwin studying biological phenomena, William James's way of studying the mind by actually observing it, like Galileo studying physical, Darwin studying the biological, William James studying the mental. As contemplatives observe carefully states of consciousness, multiple dimensions are revealed. Not through analysis, not through mathematics, not through inference, but through direct observation. As the dust of the coarse mind settles, as the atmospheric distortions of the ordinary psyche are transcended, dissipate, burn off, and you penetrate to the substrate consciousness, you find there is a space of awareness and a dimension of consciousness that is waiting to be discovered, and it has its own distinct qualities. It's the relative deep space of the mind. And you can launch your platform up there and use that as your observatory for going even further, breaking through that field, almost like a gravitational field, breaking through it and going into hyperspace, Dhammadhatu, the absolute space of phenomena that is beyond relative space-time. It is that out of which relative space-time emerges. So that's the hypothesis that has been tested and tested and tested for many, many hundreds of years in the Buddhist tradition. You will never understand the substrate consciousness by studying what's happening in the brain while a person is experiencing shamatha. You'll be looking at chemicals. You'll be looking at electromagnetic fields. That's all you will see, because that's all that's there. Very complex configurations, extremely sophisticated, subtle, magnificent configurations of chemicals and electricity. But you'll never see a single mental event. In fact, I was just reading a statement by another world-class neuroscientist focusing on consciousness, and he said this simple question, and a simple issue, and I quote him almost verbatim. He said, when a neuroscientist comes to a person who is or is not experiencing pain like in a kneecap, science has nothing to say. That's his statement. Science has nothing to say. Are you experiencing pain or not? Science has nothing to say. We don't know. Because you just don't know, because it's a subjective experience and cannot be measured. So, but it can be measured. All sentient beings measure pain, our own, and we don't like it. Whether we're neuroscientists or bed bugs, we're all in bed together. So what is this as we venture into consciousness? And Padmasambhava says of the method that we ventured into yesterday, this may actually lead to the identification of rikpa, this pristine awareness. Of course, you've heard about it many times, but to allude to it just a little bit more. Breaking through to a dimension of consciousness that is beyond space and time, beyond all conceptual frameworks, although one can still talk about it. And of course, there are many, many books written about it. There will be many more, commentaries, great accounts, and so forth. But by those in the tradition, for example, the Dzogchen tradition, it's not the only one, it's perfectly well known that all these words are simply designed to lead you there, not designed to describe what it's like to be there. They can only give you more concepts, but you need to use the methods to transcend the conceptual realm and venture into this dimension of consciousness called, in the Vajrayana tradition, called the very subtle consciousness, the innate mind of clear light. Those two are synonymous. The innate mind of clear light, very subtle consciousness. Called Buddha nature, called primordial consciousness, pristine awareness, Sugatagarbha, Tathagatagarbha, all of these referring to the same. How does it relate to the earliest recordings of the Buddhist teachings in the Pali Canon? Is there anything there? Or is this all Mahayana Vajrayana Dzogchen talk? And I think there are very compelling reasons to conclude that in fact there are explicit references to this dimension of consciousness in the teachings of the historical Buddha recorded in the Pali Canon. It's an area where what we generally know is that the Buddha responded with noble silence to the following question. Who's an arhat? An arhat is a person who's realized nirvana, whose mental afflictions are completely and irreversibly purified, gone, and this person will no longer be thrown into another rebirth by the power of karma and klesha. On that there's agreement, Theravada, Mahayana, everybody. Freedom from all mental afflictions, and no longer, that is, when the arhat dies, all Buddhist schools agree that arhat, doesn't matter whether male or female, human or non-human, will never again be propelled, thrown, cast into another rebirth by the power of karma and klesha. Karma and klesha. Karma and mental afflictions. Now, the Buddha has been asked, as recorded in the Pali Canon, what happens to an arhat, though? Now we're speaking from the Theravada Pali Canon, Theravada interpretation. But what happens? What happens? You know, so the arhat is there, and we see these many accounts of arhats in the Pali Canon. No matter what comes up, no matter what happens, they never respond with anger, never with craving, never with delusion, ever, ever, ever. I was reading one account of he was a boy, I think he was 7 years old. 7 years old. Yeah, Pali Canon, I'm pretty sure of the age. Kid, achieved arhatship. A kid. And even as an arhat, he was still serving, he's a novice. And so he's serving his teacher, who was a senior monk, and who had guided him, as I recall, guided him to achieving nirvana, which of course he did very, very fast. And the teacher one day just, there was an accident. There was an accident. It was with a stick. And complete accident, completely innocent. But the teacher poked out the eye of the student. Blinded him, and blinded him, I think, in just one eye. I think so. Pretty sure. But blind, for sure, at least one eye blinded him. It went right into his eye. Nobody at fault. It was just one of those things that happened. And the student never even mentioned it. He never even mentioned it, you know. And it came up later, and the other monks noted, oh, and they were upset. Oh, you blinded him. And the young monk, oh, but these things happen. You know, complete, just not a ripple, you know. So there it is. You are simply free of mental afflictions. Your heart is open. But then the question comes up, okay, well, that's pretty good. But what happens when you die? So you're not propelled by karma and klesha into any future rebirth. Very good. But so what? Are you annihilated? Because what is also said, and once again, a complete unanimity among all schools of Buddhism, you have your five skandhas. You have your body, you have feelings, you have discernment, you have a whole array of mental factors, and then you have the six modes of consciousness, five sensory and mental. All of these are conditioned, all of these are brought about by previous karma and klesha. Okay, so they're all within samsara, they're all fruits of karma and klesha, conditioned as they are, and they're all coarse, referring to the coarse level, right? And there's a unanimity in all schools of Buddhism, all five of those skandhas, including the fifth one, which includes all six currents of mental consciousness on the coarse level, terminated, cut, obliterated, become non-existent. So everything that we normally identify with, this is me and mine. That is, this is really, really mine. Not simply something I acquire like an iPhone, but my body, my mind, my thoughts, my emotions, my memories, my, all of that is terminated. All that Alan Wallace, as this individual, this human being, identifies with, this is me, terminated, never to come back again. And so the question comes, what then? And the question was asked, I think it was by Malumjaputta, if I remember, with a number of questions, to which the Buddha very famously responded with noble silence. Noble silence. And it's called noble silence, not because, gee, I don't know, nobody ever asked me that before. I don't know, I'll get back to you later. Not that. I don't know. That's dumb silence. This was noble silence. This was the silence of an Arya, a silence of an Arhat, of a Buddha. Noble silence, and I think the general interpretation is that for that interlocutor who asked that question, no matter what the Buddha said, it would be misleading for that person. If I say he does exist, then you're going to reify that and you'll be wrong. If I say he doesn't exist, you're going to reify that and you're going to be wrong. No matter what I say, if you say he quasi-exists, you'll reify that and you'll be wrong again. If I say he exists, doesn't exist, both or neither, no matter what I say, you're going to get it wrong. So, noble silence. That was a really bad imitation, wasn't it? I'll work on it. But that wasn't always the case. The Buddha didn't always respond to noble silence to that issue. And that there's a source, I've cited it in my book, Mind and the Balance. It's at least one source, but it's a clear source. In which the Buddha does refer to a mode of consciousness that is still present after. our heart's death. It's unconditioned. It's unobservable, literally unobservable or non-manifesting. To whom? To everybody else. That is, if you're an ordinary sentient being, even if you're a clairvoyant sentient being, let's imagine that I'm some great yogi, samadhi type yogi with really great paranormal ability, and I have knowledge of other people's minds. That's one of the extrasensory perceptions. This is make-believe, of course. But let's imagine that, and I'm looking around and I'm seeing everybody's thoughts and noting their consciousness and so forth. And Carissa knows I'm going to pick on her. And Carissa is this youngster that just is achieved nirvana. And then, and then she decides, I'm out of here. And so she gets rid of her body. And I've been watching Carissa's mind, just sneaking into her mind, watching thoughts and images come up. And then, she dies. Well, I'm this yogi with clairvoyance, and where I was watching Carissa, it suddenly, whoosh, blank screen. Hey, she should have gone someplace. Where's she going? Where's her next rebirth? She should be wandering around in the Bardo right now. Where's that Gandharva who used to be Carissa? She's gone. She was there, and then, poof, gone. Unobservable to a person like me. Because those six modes of consciousness, all five skandhas, they are just being cut, and suddenly it's a disappearing act. But does this mean that now Carissa goes from experiencing to obliteration? Nothing. The answer is no. Unequivocally, absolutely not. Anybody who believes that, they're just wrong. And that is a wrong for Buddhism, because there is no school of Buddhism that asserts that after the arhat passes away, you just become annihilated. There isn't any. There are some deluded Buddhists that think that, but they don't have any basis. Here is the Buddha's actual statement, that there is this unobservable dimension of consciousness that is unconditioned. Unconditioned. Non-manifested. Of the innate, and then there are multiple references here and there, not a lot, but they are there, of the nature of immutable bliss. Luminous. Pure. Unconditioned. Unborn, unceasing. And that's what Carissa, the post-living arhat, is experiencing. But she's not Carissa anymore. She has no gender. She's not a person. She doesn't have any coarse consciousness at all. That all dissolved. Now it's unborn. This is a big deal. This is unborn, unceasing. And it's not that Carissa lost. I like to be specific. So Carissa, Paola, Maria doesn't make any difference. Everybody knows that, yeah? But what is very clearly also not the case is that Carissa just lost her mind and then she got somebody else's, God's, or Adi Buddha's, or Samadabhadra's. So she just spit out hers and got another one. Not that way. She didn't get somebody else's consciousness. That is completely clear in all schools of Buddhism. Okay? So, this gets interesting. So before Carissa achieved arhatship, she already had a coarse mind, she already had a bhavanga. And then she achieved arhatship, and then eventually she dies. The continuum of the bhavanga, which is conditioned, terminated. Coarse mind, Carissa's mind, terminated. But there's something else that is unborn, that is all that she's experiencing now. And it's primordial stillness. It's not doing anything. It's unconditioned. It's primordially, absolutely still, without movement, without coming and going, birth or death, and so forth and so on. But if that consciousness is unborn, and it doesn't come from somebody else. If it's unborn, let's imagine that she is an arhat, dies at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Right on the right of the button. Right? And at 3:05, that's 3:01, 3 minutes and 1 second. And that's all that's being experienced is this dimension of unconditioned pure consciousness. And it's unborn. And that's all she's experiencing at 3:01. Then, since it's unborn, it must have been existing already at 3 o'clock. Because it's unborn. It's not freshly arising. and at two o'clock and 59 minutes, it's unborn. And 5 years earlier, because it's unborn. And three lifetimes earlier, because it's unborn. In other words, for the whole continuum of Carissa's this life and all previous lives, that unborn dimension of consciousness must have been there all along. Why don't we call that Buddha nature? Or is that something else? And that is now, okay, so that's Theravada. That's as far as we can go. But now let's go to Mahayana. Mahayana says all sentient beings are imbued with Buddha nature. Well, let's go to Dzogchen. Buddha nature is Rigpa. It's unconditioned, of the nature of immutable bliss. It's primordially still, utterly transcendent, beyond space and time. And it's already there as the essential nature of your own awareness. Now that's the Dzogchen view. It's very common in Vajrayana, actually in Mahayana as a whole. And then there's the view from the Pali Canon of this unconditioned consciousness. Do you imagine that Carissa has two unconditioned consciousnesses? A Theravada, Pali Canon, unconditioned consciousness of immutable bliss, that's unborn, unceasing, and so forth, and then another one that's Mahayana, that is has all the same characteristics, or do you think maybe they're the same? In which case, we've just fingered Buddha nature in the Pali Canon. And the notion that Carissa would have two seems to me just flat out silly. Does this mean that an arhat upon death has become a vidyadhara? Does this mean that an arhat, while dwelling in the direct, non-conceptual, unmediated realization of nirvana, is actually realizing rigpa, which would make that person a vidyadhara, which is equivalent to Mahayana path of accumulation of seeing with the Vajrayana spin? The answer is no. No doubt about it. But the arhat after death, is that arhat realizing some other dimension of consciousness other than Buddha nature, Tathagarbha, and so forth? In other words, that would be two. Since he's Hinayana, he doesn't get the Dzogchen one, he gets the Hinayana one. Well, once again, this is sounding silly. Wait a minute, it's unconditioned, it's unborn. And why was the Buddha abiding in noble silence? Because it's beyond all conceptual elaborations, whatever you think about it, you'll get wrong. So, here's a hypothesis. Everything I've said thus far, I think, is based upon really sound scholarship, careful reading. But no, I'm going to stick with sound scholarship and careful reading. The Mahayana and then the Vajrayana tradition in particular says this, that is there a difference when a person following the Sutrayana path, simply following Shamatha, Vipassana, Bodhicitta, but with no Vajrayana, no Dzogchen, no Mahamudra, just following Sutrayana path, when such an individual gains a direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness, that person, and thereby becomes, let's say, an Arya, let's say a Arya Bodhisattva, Bodhicitta, okay? So an Arya Bodhisattva has direct realization of emptiness. That realization, and the realization of emptiness that comes to a person who is highly advanced along the stage of completion within Vajrayana. Through the stage of completion practices of bringing the very subtle energies into the indestructible drop at the heart and realizes emptiness by way of Vajrayana methods. Are those two the same? The same. That who followed the Sutrayana and the one who followed stage of generation, stage of completion, and did this whole transfiguration, this whole transmutation of the vital energies, the mind, and so forth, to realize emptiness by way of practices like Dhumma and so forth. Are they the same? And here's the answer. So there's no Alan Wallace here. And that is, the emptiness they are realizing is exactly the same. There's no superficial emptiness or deeper emptiness. There's no Vajrayana emptiness and Sutrayana emptiness. It's Dhamma Dhatu. It's ultimate nature of reality. But the mind with which emptiness is apprehended is different. For the person on the Sutrayana path, the mind that apprehends emptiness is a relatively coarse mind. It's coarse or subtle. With Vajrayana practice, stage of completion, the mind that apprehends emptiness is the innate mind of clear light, the very subtle mind. So the mind with which one apprehends emptiness is different. One is apprehending emptiness with rikpa. The other one is apprehending emptiness with a coarser dimension of awareness. And so that's all the arhat, for even if the arhat lived for 80 or 100 years and just dwelled in nirvana many, 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 many times before finally perishing, all from the Mahayana perspective. So there's no Alan Wallace here. If I have an opinion, I'll let you know. But so far, this is just straight classic teachings from the Mahayana perspective now, though. And that is this arhat following Sravakayana path, realizing nirvana, realizing emptiness, because they are the same, will always be realizing it with a coarse mind, the coarse mind that is conditioned among the five skandhas. That one. Realizing emptiness from that perspective. Realizing. Well, let's imagine that the arhat is abiding in that meditative equipoise, focusing on nirvana, realizing nirvana, and while dwelling in such meditation, dies. Then in that moment of death, the whole dissolution taking place, mind collapsing into substrate consciousness or into bhavanga, because that's exactly what it is, your coarse mind, as you're dwelling in that samadhi, your coarse mind dissolving into the bhavanga, and then you've stopped being dead. Because when it dissolves into bhavanga, that's when you're dead. But then you stop being dead. Because the bhavanga then dissolves, and all that's left is unconditioned, primordial, unborn consciousness. You continue realizing nirvana, but no longer from a relative plane, from the perspective of unconditioned consciousness, realizing unconditioned nirvana. Finally, there's a symmetry there. Because nirvana is unconditioned, and the realization of it by an unconditioned, unborn mind is also unconditioned. Welcome home. Welcome home. So the arhat post-death will have realized rikpa, but only, and now here's the interpretation. It had to come one. Okay, here's my opinion. I knew it was going to come. And that is the arhat after death would be realizing rikpa in its primordial stillness, its non-manifestive aspect, but not realizing the dynamic creative power of the compassion, of the power of Buddha mind, and of the consciousness that directly apprehends the full range of phenomena. You'll recall the two types of deepest knowledge, that which realizes reality as it is, the ontological, probes right to the level of nirvana, the arhat's got that. But what a Buddha has also is primordial wisdom, consciousness of the full range of phenomena. That the arhat doesn't have before death, doesn't have after death, but does have realization of rikpa in its inactive primordial stillness aspect, but not in its creative effulgence, and has it only after death. So in this way, what St. Augustine said about Christian contemplation would be true of the Theravada. And that is, it begins in this life. And even though you achieve nirvana in this life, you're an arhat in this life, you don't realize unconditioned consciousness until after death. Because it's only then that you, how do you say, your coarse mind dissolves irreversibly into unconditioned consciousness. So Dzogchen and stage of completion practice, both in different ways, one much more developmental, stage of completion practice, one much more discovery, Dzogchen Mahamudra, is exactly designed to lead us in this lifetime to an unmediated identification and realization of unconditioned, unborn, pristine, primordial consciousness in this lifetime, in this lifetime. That which an arhat realizes only after death. Okay? So these are the multiple dimensions, just as string theory, superstring theory, conceptually, is this majestic symphony of mathematics, conceptually leading you to flights of incredibly abstract and beautiful imagination, without any empirical evidence behind it. That's why it's still just a theory. There's no evidence to support superstring theory. It's a magnificent theory, though. But as there are multiple mentions there that the physicist, the mathematical physicist, enters into conceptually and imagines dimension upon dimension beyond what we directly perceive, here the contemplative, probing into the depths of consciousness, directly perceives, not by way of concepts or inference, dimension upon dimension of consciousness that will never, ever be fathomed by studying behavior or brain correlates, any more than you're going to understand string theory by studying the behavior and brain correlates of mathematicians. Oh, not so? Want to meditate? Let's go for it. Settle your body in its natural state, your respiration in its natural rhythm. And calm and soothe your mind with the quality of ease, stillness, and clarity by way of mindfulness of breathing for a little while. with your eyes open, your gaze very gently cast downwards, very softly, without focusing on any object, for just a little while. Simply be present without doing anything at all. Be present. Be conscious. You can't help it. And since you're not doing anything else, be conscious of being conscious. Now, like a marathon runner who stretches first, limbers up before setting out on the long run, let's limber up by stretching, expanding our awareness of the space of the mind, the space of awareness itself. Let's do so by first of all directing awareness, without shifting the eyes or the gaze, an exercise in mental awareness. Direct your attention straight up into space, but now without visualizing any image of an expanding balloon or an arrow or any other vector, just direct your awareness upwards, as far as you can, without an object and without visualization, just up into space. This is a bit like stretching a rubber band. And now release the rubber band and let your awareness come rest effortlessly, with no tension, in its own place, illuminating its own nature. And again, without moving your eyes, not an exercise of visual perception, but directing your mental awareness, direct your awareness to the right, out into space, as far as your mind can reach. Back to the center, total relaxation, effortless, not doing. The same way, now extend your awareness to the left, out into space as far as your mind can reach. While sustaining the awareness of awareness as you do so. Release back to the center. And drop your awareness down into space below, as far as your mind will reach, while sustaining the flow of awareness of awareness. back to the center. And now rest for a while, luminously, in stillness, in the consciousness of the one who is aware. And release your awareness out of the sense of being present in your head, if that is in fact where you experience it. As if you were falling asleep. Experiencing the very perfection of relaxation and release, let your awareness descend to the heart. Be aware of awareness from the perspective of the heart. You may visualize the heart chakra to begin with. Imagine descending there. And then releasing all visualization, all mental imagery, and rest in the awareness of awareness in your heart. Then release your awareness into space. 360 degrees, total release, without boundary, without an object. In this open spaciousness, simply be aware of awareness, the awareness that illuminates that space. Between sessions, of course, continuity is the key. So it might be helpful to have kind of a finite set. So it's not just kind of practice Dharma in a nebulous fashion, but a finite set of options that would be kind of primary options. The first of these is when you were just walking about, just engaging, doing whatever you need to do, walking, swimming, brushing your teeth, or so forth. One possibility that really does maintain continuity is let your awareness come into the senses, be fully present in your body, if you're brushing your teeth, the tactile sensations, if you're out walking, feeling the air on your skin, the sky, the space, the natural environment, and being totally present. Which is to say, you're filling your awareness with the reality that is being dished up to you, rather than being caught up, abducted, and carried away by OCDD. So there's one possibility. It's refreshing, it's expansive, it's open, spacious, really good. Another possibility, and you can of course do any or all of these, is to be aware that, hey, I'm still breathing. And so maintain gently, as you're doing whatever needs to be done in the world, maintain an ongoing awareness, a peripheral awareness, the in and outflow of the breath. That really maintains continuity. Something really nice, just that rhythm all the way through as you're walking and what have you. Another possibility is recognizing, oh, I still have a mind. Fancy that. Events still arising, thoughts, memories, images, and so forth. Continue as you're doing whatever you need to do in the world, settling your mind in its natural state, observing what arises in the mind without distraction, without grasping. You do that between sessions. Another possibility, you know it's coming now. Huh, I'm not dead. Awareness of awareness, continue that. Flickering back and forth between attending to the environment, whatever needs to be done or attended to in the world, and just that awareness of awareness coming in, coming in. Another possibility. Whole spectrum there. And final one is that you might want to activate the more dynamic, the imaginative, the creative capacities of your mind, and that is especially whenever, how do you say, sensorily encountering a sentient being or mentally having a sentient being come to mind. Say, oh, sentient being, that's right, I'm not alone. And practice any of the four immeasurables. So that should pretty well fill the day. You know? And then it's Dharma all the way through. So I love to come back to the quintessential from Dom Dumba. Give up attachment to this life. Have the trust, the confidence, the faith that it's really okay. You won't die of starvation. You'll somehow make it through. Reality will rise up to meet you, even if you give up attachment to this life. And let your mind become Dharma. And then you can become fearless. Because if you've given up attachment to this life, nobody can take anything away. And if your mind is Dharma, nobody can take your Dharma away. Because your mind is Dharma. Let's be fearless. Why not? Life is short.